Hawaii was once an independent country with a constitutional monarchy similar to England. Julia Flynn Seiler has detailed how the islands became the 50th state and rights of its people, culture, and turbulent economy in her new book, Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, The Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure. It's published by Grove Atlantic, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Ms. Seiler to our show today. Hello.
Aloha, Leonard.
You're not a Hawaiian, we should point out. Do you speak any Hawaiian?
I've picked up a few Hawaiian words along the way.
Like haole.
Oh, definitely like haole. And that's a word most of your listeners probably know means a white person from the mainland.
Well, when was Hawaii first settled by humans? How long after the islands had been formed and became habitable?
Well, the best guess is that around 200 A.D., Polynesians from other islands, maybe Tahiti or the Marquesas, paddled double-hulled canoes thousands of miles and discovered this chain of volcanic islands.
So it's fairly recent.
Fairly recent. And imagine they lived there for 1,500 years, completely isolated, no contact with the West.
But it is, this is a chain of volcanic islands, and the Big Island is still being formed, isn't it?
It's astonishing. You can take hikes out and see the lava flowing down and new land being created before your eyes.
Now, to come to Hawaii, they had to, you said they came in rather crude boats. They traveled pretty far, didn't they? The Pacific Ocean can be rather turbulent.
Very turbulent. I wouldn't say they're crude boats. I'd say they were masterful boats, and they were astonishing navigators. They navigated using the stars, and they brought with them things like shoots of sugar cane and pigs and dogs.
And shoots of sugar cane, not knowing whether it would grow well in the soil that they were coming to?
We can only guess. They assumed that eventually they'd hit land and they would be able to plant and fish and keep animals.
Well, how many people are we talking about? If it's a really small number, there could be all sorts of problems, as we've seen in Pitcairn Island.
Well, you know, that was one of the things that really astonished me when I first started researching this book, was that at the time of first Western contact, 1778, when Captain Cook reached the islands, there were an estimated 300,000 to 400,000 Native Hawaiians living there. That's a lot of people.
Was Captain Cook surprised to find an inhabited island so far away from any place else?
Well, he had been exploring the globe for the last few decades. He was probably the 18th century's most brave and magnificent explorer. He was looking for the Northwest Passage. And the North Pacific in particular seemed like a vast, empty ocean. So to come across these islands must have been a great surprise. And likewise, the Native Hawaiians thought that Captain Cook was Lono, one of their gods. And so they welcomed him and shared food and welcomed the sailors.
Big mistake.
Big mistake, because those sailors, of course, carried diseases that the Hawaiians had absolutely no resistance to.
Was this similar to what happened to Native Americans?
Well, in the case of Native Americans, there were very tragic instances where disease was spread intentionally in blankets. There was nothing I came across in my 4 years of research in the archives to suggest that people spread disease intentionally. But, of course, there was sexual congress between the Hawaiians and the sailors, and syphilis and smallpox quickly decimated the Native Hawaiian population.
Was the culture similar to some of the other Polynesian cultures like Tahiti?
It was similar. There were many gods that were worshipped. It was a very hierarchical society. It was a very frightening society. For example, if a commoner cross the path of an alii or a chief, that commoner could be put to death instantly. There were human sacrifices.
Well, that's unlike Tahiti, where it just seems like everybody was having a great time and you could survive simply because there was so much stuff growing there that you could pick it off of a tree.
Well, certainly the Polynesian society was blessed, or across the islands, was blessed with bounty. And again, one of the things that I so loved was finding early images of surfing. And when Captain Cook arrived in the islands, he found a culture that would surf the waves on 20-foot boards. And the alii, the chiefs, were the best surfers.
How soon after Cook's arrival did missionaries come to the islands?
The missionaries arrived, the first company arrived in 1820, And it was a group of about 18 people, and they came from Boston. And their goal was to spread the word of God.
And had they learned about the islands from Cook? Because he had been there a long time before.
I believe they'd heard about the islands through the whalers. And the whalers were making their way from Boston all the way to China, and they would stop in what were then known as the Sandwich Islands.
And the missionaries came to convert people.
Yes.
Anything else?
Well, they spread the culture that they found was one, it was an oral culture. There was no reading and writing. And so the missionaries quickly taught the Hawaiians how to read, and they introduced a written Hawaiian language for the first time. And printing presses. And very soon, within a few decades, Hawaii became one of the most literate countries in the world. And likewise, it adopted a constitutional monarchy that was based on Great Britain's.
Was there a particular aspect of Hawaiian culture that allowed Europeans and Americans to so quickly, allowed all of these outsiders to quickly gain an upper hand economically?
Very much so. The Hawaiians, the system of ownership, of land ownership, was more communal. And the alii, the chiefs, held land essentially in a kind of trust for the common people. When Westerners came, they instituted something known as mehele. It was the great land division. And very quickly, the commoners lost out on land, and Westerners bought the land. And by the mid to late 19th century, the Westerners owned the vast majority of arable land in the Hawaiian Islands.
There's a Hawaiian saying about the goals of missionaries and their descendants. What is it?
Yes, that saying is still heard often today. And
very bitter.
It's a very bitter saying. It is, they came to do good, and they did very well indeed.
So do you think that they really did come with idealism and then quickly understand that there was money to be made?
Well, I think we need to think about it in the context of Protestantism and the Protestant work ethic and capitalism. And they were so intertwined that part of spreading Christianity was also to spread capitalism. And that's surely what they did as their descendants started sugar plantations, opened banks, started newspapers.
Most of them from the United States?
Many of them from the United States.
And most of them from New England. Why not people from the Pacific Coast?
Well, there were people from the Pacific Coast as time went on, particularly after the Civil War. And the Civil War disrupted the supply of sugar. Most of the sugar production was in Louisiana and the South. But some very enterprising businessmen realized that the Hawaiian Islands were perfectly suited to growing sugarcane, and so they headed over.
But earlier, I guess, it was the whalers who had come and brought missionaries with them.
That's right, or told the story about this tropical paradise, yes.
My guest is Julia Flynn Seiler, whose latest book is Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, the Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure. It is published by Atlantic. What is by Grove Atlantic? Is it really our first? Because to some degree, this reminds me of what happened in Texas.
Mm-hmm. You would have to. I think that the difference here is that this is a sovereign nation that had been recognized as such by France, by Great Britain, by Germany. And it was off our continental shore. It was the first time that we were looking towards the Pacific, and we took over an independent country. Now, with much of the continental United States, we purchased vast swaths of territory.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Texas, what we did is we were invited in, and then we just took it over. And to some degree, that seems to be what happened here. There was resistance in both cases, although there was no Santa Ana and no Alamo in Hawaii. How did you research this book? Do people still talk about what happened way back then?
People feel passionately about the history of Hawaii. There are people in Hawaii today who still maintain that Hawaii is illegally occupied by the United States. For example,
they reject statehood?
They reject statehood. There is a sovereignty movement in Hawaii today. I spent 4 years researching this book and made many, many trips to the State Archives of Hawaii, which are in downtown Honolulu. Twice during the period I was there, there were attempts to occupy Iolani Palace, which is the symbol of Hawaiian identity in the islands.
Are people still speaking Hawaiian?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question. The missionaries actively suppressed the Hawaiian language and encouraged Hawaiians to speak English. But starting in the 70s, there was a Hawaiian renaissance, and now more and more people are starting to speak Hawaiian again.
One of your sources was the journals of the last queen, Lili Uoikalani.
That's true.
I almost pronounced her name well.
That was pretty good, Leonard. I've had quite a bit of trouble learning how to pronounce these names as well. Her diaries, she had diaries. Some of them were coded, and as well, I was very fortunate because recently a very large collection of newly transcribed letters between members of the royal family were gifted to the Hawaiian State Archives, and I got early access to them. So this book publishes some of those letters for the first time.
Is that, I guess, that independence movement, which is different from Puerto Rico's because we are talking about a state here, it would involve secession, but still... Is it also monarchist? Do they want to return the royal family to the throne?
There are a number of people who have different ideas of what should happen. And I will share one small anecdote with you. I was in downtown Honolulu on the grounds of the palace one evening, and I bumped into some native Hawaiian people. And they said, "We are the royal family, and this is my grandmama's palace." And, you know, there are members of the royal family about.
Although the royal family was a fairly late development, wasn't it?
It was.
The islands weren't unified until fairly late in their history.
They were unified at the very end of the 18th century. And after that point, they adopted, the whole Native Hawaiians adopted a monarchy, as I mentioned.
Was it based on a European model?
It was based on Great Britain's monarchy, yes.
But not the United States, even though there were so many Americans there.
That was one of the biggest surprises in researching this book. I mean, I remember coming across a photograph taken a few days before the overthrow of the last queen. It was torn and faded. You could barely see it. And there's the last queen. And I guess I had imagined a Hawaiian queen wearing a loose-fitting gown or something. No, she was a tightly corseted Victorian-looking lady with a diamond tiara and footmen wearing white knee breeches.
A writer from Copenhagen called in to say that he heard that, David, in fact, from Copenhagen, that he heard that the Spanish had discovered Hawaii before Captain Cook, only their latitudes were different. So people didn't really get the fact that we're talking about the same place.
That's absolutely fascinating. I'd love to hear more about that.
Now, your subtitle is not just the last queen, and we'll talk more about her. She actually married an American, the son of a ship captain, and not the happiest marriage we could imagine.
No, rather a fraught marriage, and they really went their separate ways. He had quite the roving eye. His name was John Dominus.
He had children with other women.
He did.
Would be seen as an insult to most queens.
Well, one of the reasons that I came to love Liliuokalani, my character, and the last queen so much, was that she had a big heart, and she adopted children, and she, in fact, embraced his children that he had with other women.
Now, the subtitle also says Sugar Kings, and we talked about whalers, we've talked about missionaries. They all seem to be working at cross purposes.
They are. It's quite a big mix of various interests, and perhaps the most colorful and unexpected Sugar King was a German-American by the name of Claus Spreckels, kind of like Santa Claus, based in San Francisco.
Now, how did he get the nickname Sugar King?
Well, not only was he dominant in California sugar industry, and you can still see traces of him today in San Francisco. You can see the Spreckels Mansion. You can see the Coronado Hotel down in San Diego that his family owned. but he owned vast swaths of plantation land on the island of Maui, as well as the principal steamship line.
Now, is the soil on the islands particularly conducive to growing sugar?
Well, the lower slopes of the volcanic soil are very conducive. The key challenge for growing sugar was irrigation and getting the water to the fields, and that's something that Claus Spreckels did. He had a very early irrigation canal that he built on Maui.
Now, sugar was grown in the Caribbean as well on plantations using slaves. There was no slavery in Hawaii, was there?
No, there was no slavery in Hawaii. However, it was backbreaking, very difficult work, and the native Hawaiians did not want to do that. And that's why this really, Lost Kingdom is really also a story about racial politics and about labor issues.
Because a lot of Chinese and Japanese were brought in kind of as indentured servants?
Yes. They typically have five-year contracts, and as soon as those contracts were over, they would set up shops or do anything else rather than work in those sugarcane fields.
Now, we've talked about sugar. You said that the Polynesians brought sugar to the island. What about pineapples? I associate pineapples with Hawaii, and if you travel on the islands, you just see these dull plantations that go on for mile after mile after mile.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up that point, because it's a funny historical coincidence. Sanford Dole, who was the son of missionaries, was deeply involved in Queen Liliuokalani's overthrow in 1893. In fact, he became the first president of the Republic of Hawaii. And it was his nephew who set up the Dole Pineapple Company, which is still in Hawaii.
So what we have is a situation where there's a power struggle going on, but they could have lived with the queen, couldn't they? Why was she overthrown?
She was overthrown because she was not content to be a mere figurehead. She wanted to regain some powers, and she tried to introduce a new constitution that would do that, and that was really used as a pretext for her overthrow.
Did she was there any possibility that she could have had success if that constitution had gone through in 1893?
Well, I guess it is a question, Leonard, of how you define success. I think that Hawaii's biggest problem, it was its strategic position between California and Asia, and almost inevitably some great nation was going to snatch it up.
Of course, native Hawaiians were not allowed to vote, which also skews any elections in Hawaii at that time.
Well, and it was quite confusing who could vote and who couldn't vote. Yes.
And then she appealed to the United States government to help her.
She did. She spent really the rest of her life appealing to the United States, because what happened in those few days in 1893 was the transfer of 1.8 million acres of land from native Hawaiians to a very small group of businessmen. And she spent the next few decades trying to get that land back, unsuccessfully, I'm sad to say.
She also had a niece and heir, Princess Kaiulani, who tried to help her.
Yes, Princess Kaiulani was just a breathtakingly lovely young woman, educated at boarding schools in England. And she, as soon as she heard about the overthrow, she took a steamer back to New York and really waged a propaganda campaign in New York and Washington to appeal for reinstating her aunt to the throne.
And she it was assumed that she would assume the Hawaiian throne after her aunt. How long after the end of the Hawaiian monarchy did the islands become a U.S. territory?
Became a territory in the... Now I'm going to stumble a little bit. Before the queen died. The queen died in 1918, and it became a territory, and everyone who was in Hawaii at that point became a naturalized U.S. citizen. So one could argue that the queen was the last American queen. She was a naturalized citizen when she died.
But you end this book before Hawaii achieved statehood.
That's true. Hawaii achieved statehood, of course, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1949, and it became a state in 1959.
Now, Queen Liliuokalani was also a songwriter and a musician. Do any of her songs survive?
Oh, my goodness. I think anybody who watches Saturday morning cartoons will recognize Aloha Oe, which is probably the most famous Hawaiian song. She wrote that. She wrote more than 100 other songs. She was a very gifted composer.
And what is your... Well, first of all, the Hawaiians are a minority in their own islands now, aren't they?
Yes, the vast majority of Hawaiians, according to the latest census, live in California.
And every Californian I ever spoke to wanted to go to Hawaii.
And usually do. Going back and forth, there's very strong connections between the West Coast and the islands.
Well, if you don't love the bad things about California, at least in the minds of a lot of people, Hawaii is paradise.
Mm.
But Hawaii is a difficult island to live on. The islands are difficult to live on, aren't they? Prices are very high. And you do feel like you really are far away from the rest of the world.
Well, I think things are changing with all of us being connected via the internet. But yes, it's a very racially divisive state, I would say that.
Julia Flynn Seiler will be participating in a panel discussion, not about Hawaii, but about Robert Mondavi, the subject of her last book, tonight at 6 o'clock at the New School's Arnhold Hall at West 13th Street. For more information and tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. You wrote about the Mondavis, and how did that lead you to write about Hawaii and its last queen?
I've always been fascinated by family stories, and these were two great American families, the Hawaiian last dynasty of Hawaii and, of course, Napa Valley's wine dynasty.
Lost Kingdom, Hawaii's Last Queen, The Sugar Kings, and America's First Imperial Adventure is published by Grove Atlantic. And my great thanks to its author, Julia Flynn Seiler, for being on the show today.
Mahalo, Leonard.